I'm Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel. This is a podcast episode brought to you by Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. Our Vayikra series, Kedushas in the Details, explores the way the laws in the book try and elevate each of our most basic human functions: food intake, bodily functions, relationships, spaces of worship, and time. This year, I'm taking a particularly honest and candid look at the way these laws do or do not yet function in our lives. I remind you that sponsoring a podcast is a wonderful way to mark any occasion. Write me at podcast@matan.org.il or check out the donation webpage on the Matan website or contact the office directly. Parshat Kedoshim opens with the famous verse, Kedoshim tiyu ki kadosh ani Hashem Elohechem. The list that follows this general injunction to be kadosh is varied in a somewhat puzzling way, from keeping Shabbat, gifts to the poor, agricultural laws about not eating from fruit trees until the fourth year, idolatry prohibitions. The lack of clear connection between the mitzvot is confusing and will be the topic of today's conversation. The last chapter of the parsha addresses the punishments for various egregious sins, like recalling dead spirits, prohibited sexual relationships, and cursing one's parents. This section strongly correlates worship of other gods with adultery by continually classifying it as znut, or prostitution. In this light, the sexual prohibitions mentioned and theological adultery become connected sins. Both constitute abrogation of a relationship meant to be monogamous and morally pure. To unpack some of these ideas, I have invited back to the podcast Rabbanit Nechama Goldman-Barish. Nechama teaches contemporary halakha and Talmud at Matan and Pardis, as well as in Midrashat Torah V'Avodah, MTVA. She is an active member of Beit Hillel and a graduate of Matan's Hilchata program. For previous podcast episodes with Nechama, you can flip back to episode number 109, 64, 46, and episode number 4. There's so much great Torah in those episodes. And that first one, we actually explored the writing process of a book that is currently on its way to being printed. So that's really exciting. Nechama, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
It's great to be here, Yosefa, and I'm very excited about discussing this parsha.
Yeah, so you know what, Nechama, you jump right in there. I gave you the option of a bunch of parsha, and you're like, yeah, I want to take on the topic of Kedusha. And last year, we sort of explored this idea from multiple angles, and I'm really excited because I think we're going to get at some very different ideas through this week's parsha. So why don't you sort of jump into what you want to do with this concept, this sort of ephemeral, unclear, multi-dimensional concept of Kedusha that we like to throw out sort of very glibly in our religious lives, but I think maybe it'll do us well to understand a little bit deeper what this concept really is.
Yeah, so I've long been interested in the idea that Kedusha holds within it the possibility of an ongoing relationship with God, rather than a concept of restriction or suppression of will or negation of self. In other words, a lot of times when we look at Kedusha, we look at what it excludes. Right? We think about Shabbat as being kadosh, and that excludes or restricts the other days of the week, right? They're less kadosh somehow. We look at kiddushin, the idea of marriage, as restricting one man to one woman. So there's a lot of sense of boundaried behavior, of restriction. And I know that in the past, you've discussed some of the medieval commentary on kedusha, the idea of boundaries and restriction in relationship with God. But I'm really much more interested in Kedusha as something that's very prevalent and available to us at all times, in all spaces, for all people, in creating an ongoing relationship with God. And in that sense, I'm interested in the concepts of willfulness, intentionality, consensuality, as absolutely paramount in defining what Kedusha is. And I think it syncs very well with other relational mitzvot that appear in this parsha, particularly around sexual relationships, which is not going to be the focus, but I think can be held alongside our discussion of relationship with God. You yourself have already mentioned, right, that often betrayal of God is compared to adultery, and relationship with God is compared to marriage. So there's definitely something there in the space of relationship with God that we then reference the ultimate intimacy between man and woman that we can relate to when we think of intimacy. In addition, in this week's parsha, we have the commandment to honor parents, right? Also another relational framework, which often is compared to relationship with God. And so I think Kedusha as an umbrella concept is often too greatly restricted as what it cannot hold. And I really want to look at what it can hold.
Wait, so two thoughts in response. One is that I think that the reason why it's often thought about that is simply because Rashi brings one of the older Midrashim, which say that Prushim to you, that it is about a boundary. It's about being separated, that Kedoshim. And as you said, it works for some elements on the list. And this, I think, is really important also, because we might tend to think, well, maybe Kedusha has to do with Bin Adam the Makom, has to do with our relationship with God. But then the list comes and it's mostly not about a relationship with God. It's mostly about human relationships, if you want to talk about sort of the stats or the proportionality of these lists. So I agree with you that both of those, whether we think of human versus divine dimension, or we think about, you know, boundaried versus some other explorative approach, they're both highly influenced by like categories that exist in our tradition. But as you said, they're not necessarily sort of getting at the majority of it, or even at the root of it. One other thing I just also want to throw out, I think it came up a little bit in my conversation last week with Shana Goldberg, who we spoke about her Chakot and Shmirat Negiyah together. I think that this is not something that will come up in any of the Midrashim or the commentators, but there is also a personality element here at stake, meaning for some people, their religious life, they need it to be very boundaried. I'm not talking about keeping halakha. Of course, halakha as a concept is a boundary, okay? But I'm saying that there are some people who are attracted to their avodat Hashem, which maybe we'll talk about it as Kedusha soon, but they're attracted to boundaried life. And other people want to feel freer within the context of the boundary that we're given of halakha itself. So even like whether we take Kedusha to the world of boundaries or we take it to the world of something else, there's also a certain, and again, I'm not diagnosing your personality or mine, but I'm saying at the root of those, of what draws us to each of those, there's a personality element there, which I think also plays a big part in how one seeks out something larger than themselves in their religious life. Does that make sense, or that was very esoteric?
No, that absolutely makes sense. And I think it's going to tie into the direction I'm going in, which is we develop a personal relationship to Kedusha. And as we were talking, I kept going to the pasuk that we say in Kedusha, right? Kadosh, 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 Hashem tzvaot, melo chol haaretz kevodo, right? We have this idea as holy, holy, holy God of the
hosts. It's usually the hosts. Host, I don't know right? why, but yeah.
Melo chol haaretz kevodo, right? His honor spreads and fills the whole world. And this idea that Kedusha is it's the antithesis of boundary or restricted, right? Mm. That God's Kedusha is present absolutely everywhere. And when God says Kedoshim to you, because I, God, am Kadosh, there is a mandate there to go out and experience, embody, whatever word you want to fill in. And then, you know, Rashi is a wonderful commentary and interpreter. However, often we give too much weight and we limit what really the text presents to us or gives us permission to go, you know, much, much further, much broader, much wider. And so I think both of those are essential. I mean, the idea of boundaries is very important in any relationship, and I'm going to get to that. Okay. In other words, every relationship, Yosefa, you and I, you know, are daughters of and wives of and sisters of and parents and mothers of, right? And we're employees of. And every single one of those relationships comes with boundaries and restrictions. Mm-hmm. And so somehow when it comes to God, people feel like, well, there shouldn't be any boundaries here. That gets in the way of my relationship with God. But I really, when I come to this parsha, what it allows me to do is to reflect on the brilliance in recognizing that all relationships come with commitment and obligation. All of them need a framework and boundaries. And the question is, within that, where do I find, do I restrict myself or do I open myself up to the potential of the experience of the relationship? And that's where I want to go. The idea of choosing to willingly commit, to obligate, and from that place of choice, from consent, right? that's the space in which I am taking on the obligation and the commitment with all that it entails, rather than feeling that I have to, I'm forced, right? The coercive aspect. I think many people today want boundaries, mm-hmm. but coercion is a very scary word, right? Yeah. And what happens if I can't or I won't, right? What's the consequence? What's the punishment? And I think often that gets in the way of our freeing ourselves to recognize the potential of choosing to submit or choosing to obligate myself. And I see that a lot with the younger students I work with, the fear of coercion, the fear of having to do something that makes them very anxious, threatened, angry, particularly at religion. And often I try to, okay, let's put that on the side and think about all of these relationships you have. Are there expectations? Are there boundaries? Are there restrictions? And sometimes that's a helpful hook to re-enter a conversation and say, oh, then I guess my relationship with God isn't really greatly different. Yes, different expectations, different boundaries, different framework, but really not that different when I begin to think about relationships more globally.
Wait, so let's take a step back, right? How do we mm-hmm. go from the concept of Kedusha, which I still want us to sort of like anchor it in right. the Parsha, which of mm-hmm. course you're going to help us do. How do we get from there to, as you said, these concepts of choice or of being sort of a voluntary part of the system? Let's sort of like take a step back and go deeper into
okay,
that.
Okay, sure. So I want to open the part, right? We're in Parakut Tet, and the opening second pasuk is Kedoshim tiyu ki kadosh ani Hashem Elokeichem, right? You shall be holy because I, God, am holy. The next verse, by the way, is Ish imo va'aviv tira'u, right? We immediately go into the relationship with parents. Et shabtotai tishmoru, right? Also a form of Kedusha, Kodesh, and Chol, we have Shabbat. And then in Pasuk He, right? So I'm skipping the next Pasuk Dalet is don't worship other gods. Mm-hmm. That's a betrayal mm-hmm. of one God. And then v'ki tizbechu zevach shlamim la'Hashem lirtzonchem tizbachahu, tizbachu, right? So we have a word there. And I found a beautiful idea by Aviva Richman from Hadar that she really developed a drasha of, we have here this idea of zevach, right? Of bringing sacrifice. And we'll talk a little bit within the word sacrifice, korban. We do have the idea of submission, but we also have the idea of closeness, right? The same word holds within mm-hmm. it, karev, kirva, closeness, but korban is to submit, to sacrifice. And lirtzonchem, this idea of willingness, right? With your willingness. And in fact, the Sifra, which is a very old midrash, says, what does it mean, lirtzonchem? They do not force the congregation to bring a sacrifice, right? Again, possibly talking about Sfirat HaOmer or Omer, which is a congregational sacrifice. But this idea of the Sifra already seeing within it consensuality, willingness, the antithesis of coercion, mm-hmm. no forcing. Yes, there are things you have to do. The Omer has to be brought or the communal offering has to be brought, but not by force. And what so Aviva pointed out, right, is this idea already there in the opening of the Parsha. There's a juxtaposition of the word ritzonchem, which is your willingness, right? It's not necessarily the pshat. I know how it can be translated. It could be as on your behalf. But I really think you're missing something if you don't see the use of the word ritzonchem as your willingness, that is part and parcel of this framework of Kedusha that is unfolding. And of course, we both know, Yosef, as any good sex educator, couples counselor, Madrichat Kalot knows, willingness is the most essential component in determining the ability of people to be in a healthy, oriented, loving, growth-oriented, sorry, committed, loving dynamic with one another. The willingness, mm-hmm. right, to give, to take, to submit, to sacrifice. It has to come from a place of intention, of ratzon, of b'chira, all of those things. And so suddenly you're finding it here, and it's an unusual usage because usually the word ratzon is about God's will. And this is not about God's will. This is about our will. So really, that really started me thinking about the entire arc of the Parsha, that from the beginning, the idea of the mandate, you shall be holy, and then very quickly, I have a word that has ratzon, but not God's will, my will. that to me was a very powerful juxtaposition.
Yeah, I think.
And I'm just going to, one more line. Yeah. I just want to quote Aviva Richmond before I close this. Our will and consent is powerful even in the context of obligation. What an incredible line, right? The idea that we consent to be obligated, right? There cannot be sacrifice without consent because we cannot be forced into intimacy, not with God and not with anyone else. Servitude, yes, submission, yes, and so on. But intimacy, no, that can't be forced. And I really think that now I go back to Kedusha. I think the Kedusha that we can access because God says, you know, I am Kadosh and you can be Kadosh, brings me back to the creation of human beings and the image of God and the idea that when we access and manifest Kedusha, we are creating direct intimacy with God.
Two ideas, but they're big. So hold on there for a minute, okay?
Okay,
sure. First is that you're just throwing me, you know how it is when you teach, Nechama, that you never have any idea how a class will really go, right? Something that you didn't plan well and it's like ends up being mind-blowing and something that you planned so well and it totally flopped. Okay, great. So right before Pesach, my last sort of like meeting with my group in Midalos, where I teach as well, I wanted to bring them the idea of the two freedoms of Isaiah Berlin. This is all in Hebrew. I'm doing this. Okay. So I'm doing the two freedoms and I wanted to connect it to Chirut and Pesach. Okay. I wasn't, to be quite honest, I wasn't totally prepared. Okay. So I had spent a really long time trying to really understand it and I wasn't totally sure yet how I was going to like make this super relevant to what their actual lives. And I ended up asking them in like a whim question was, what do you do in your religious life that makes you feel that you have a degree of freedom but you're within the boundaries of halacha? I mean, the assumption was you're within the boundaries, but that you feel like you have a way to be you, right? To bring what you want to sort of be present there fully. And I use the word dafka to have freedom. And it really connects for me a lot to with what you're saying, because we have this lit, and it was like this most unbelievable conversation. I was shocked at how well it went, okay? We really touched upon, these are girls, as you said, a generation where nobody likes the word being obligated. It's very, very unpopular. When you were younger, even when I was younger, like a decade later, it was like super fine. Like I don't mind being obligated to do things. Like it makes order. I think that that's what, you know, it was just like an obvious, right? And today it's very unpopular to stay very far away from the word obligated until you really need to use it. Okay. So, and in that moment, it really, what you're describing in the list of the Kedoshim is that even this very intense list of things that we need to do, a monotheistic relationship and being kind to the poor and being careful of how we treat our trees and all these different very specific elements, we have this concept of ratzon, right? Which you're saying is like, don't overlook it. And that's exactly what I was saying to them, meaning within the very clear boundaries of your religious lives, young women, right? Where do you have space where you express that ratzon that you feel is you can be authentic and bring in any of the words that everybody likes to use today? So I was just thinking about that because it's really that, you know, and it colors the entire enterprise. It's not just, oh, but there's so many psukim about obligation and then there's one about willingness. No, the entire experience is completely shifted when you have that element of ratzon, as you said so beautifully, in a human relationship. And why should it be any different with God? That was one idea.
So I do want to, I'm curious to know what some of the examples were, if you don't mind sharing. But before that, I want to segue to what just came up as I was listening to you.
Yeah.
In the opening tractate of Kiddushin, right, which is all about, again, Kiddushin has within it this idea of Kadosh, Kedusha, the separation of the man and the woman, commitment to one another. And, scholars have recognized, already the Gaonim recognized, that after the Mishnah that says a woman is niknet, a woman is acquired, kesef shtar bia, right, with money, with a document, and with sexual relations into marriage, already on the first page, there's an insertion that's actually very, very important at the very end of the first sugya, which is a bit complex. Then the sugya ends by saying, only biyadia, only if the woman accepts and knows what she's accepting, can any of this take place. And what's really fascinating there, right, is the idea that it's inserted at a relatively late stage, right? It's possibly gaonic, early gaonim, which means that until that insertion, I might have read the entire tractate as possibly being forced on the woman, right? Whether she agrees or doesn't agree. And we won't go into now the complexity of a young girl and her father and so on. There are complexities in the tractate. But overall, you start the tractate with yidiyah, right? There has to be awareness of what you are accepting. And that brings me back to our conversation. The idea of planting the word ritzon chen right at the beginning of a parsha that's about essentially obligation and commitment and expectation and so on. And all of that is part and parcel of Kedusha, which is relationship with God, can only really work where there's awareness, where there's choice. There's an idea my father actually shared with me that the word Kedusha, in building the Mishkan, obviously the root Kadosh appears a lot. There's a lot of Kedusha in the building of the Mishkan. But what's really interesting is that that the tzitz, I think, is the only garment that is considered, that is deliberately called kadosh. Mm-hmm. And the tzitz, of course, is on the forehead of the kohen, which represents the mind, the intellect, the intention, right? That's where you're going to find kedusha. And I want to bring that in because, again, all of the garments are kadosh, you could say. But the fact that it's used specifically for something that is abutting the head, which holds the brain, I think is very profound. The idea that in order to really be in a kadosh relationship with God, there has to be intention and ratzon, there has to be awareness, and the same thing with marriage, right? The kiddushin can only really be manifested when there is intention, when there's ratzon.
You know, I recently was having a conversation with my eldest daughter, who's about to be bat mitzvah, and I said to her, that we were having, it wasn't a fight, but a conversation was probably surrounding some halacha, this, that, or the other. And I said to her, you know, Esther, you're part of this world because we brought you into this religious world. I said, but everybody at some point has to make a choice that they're in it because they're in it for themselves. I said, it may happen by bat mitzvah time. It may happen later. I said, I pray that it happens, right? I said, but at some point, everybody has to make a choice that they're in. Now, I don't know if she got everything I was trying to say, but it's, I'm sure, a conversation that will repeat, you know, many times over the course of their childhoods. But it's that, right? It's that piece of, well, the Torah is telling us that, like, everybody has to ultimately make a choice at some point, whether you're aware of it constantly, whether it's constantly on your brain, right, on your mind, that you're in this, and you're in that. It's like with a marriage. You don't every day think about, oh, well, am I in this or am I out? Like, that would be exhausting and unhealthy, right? But you have moments in life where you make those choices. And I think that that's a really important piece that you're really bringing out here. I don't think I've ever thought about that when it comes to Kedusha.
I'm curious now to know, can you give one or two examples that your students gave a way in which they felt free within the framework of commitment or obligation?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was about, like, how they experience, let's say, a Shabbat or a Chagim, or spaces where, like, there's a loose rubric, but they could choose to fill it with whatever they like. Some of them felt like it had a lot to do with what they might learn or the content that they sort of pour into their religious life. Some of them, Dafka said, with dress, whether it's because they were choosing to do more than their surroundings or they chose to do a little bit less than their surroundings, but they still felt it was within the bounds of halacha. Some of them brought up dress. I think that, you know, it was, for some, it was in the actions they were doing. For some, it was in their intentions. For some, it was within their learning, right? That was also interesting.
Yeah, I once had a groom. I was teaching a couple, and the chatan, who was secular, he was marrying a woman who was more religious than he, came from a religious home, wanted to keep some aspect of Taharat Mishpacha. And he said at the end, I really came thinking all we were going to talk about is what we couldn't do. And I walked out thinking about what we can do. And I feel like you gave your students permission as well. Yeah. Often religious conversation is about restriction, is about what we can't do, what we can't eat, what malachot, right? Like, it's all about the restrictions. Yeah. And it's not enough about creating the space where we can begin to think about ourselves in relation to the divine, relation to the spiritual. And I think that those conversations are very important. And you yourself recognized that that when you saw how eagerly they engaged and listened to one another.
Just one piece to add on to that before you go is that I think that even some of the medieval ideas that get worked upon by some of also our modern greats, right? Even the Ramban, when he speaks about that, you know, you have to speak about Kedushim to you, because if you just do the mitzvot, it's just the baseline and it's not enough, and you could still be, you know, in the Valbush Torah, you could still, that idea I think is also very significant in the context of what we're saying, because I say to my kids, I say to my students, and again, mostly more importantly, what I say to my kids, and hopefully when I model, I said, it's not about what I can't do. It's about what content I fill in, right? Or what depth or layers of living I, and as you're saying, that's the spiritual experience. That's every part of our experience. It's about what I do. And I think that the Ramban is hitting at that same idea. Rav Lichtenstein also works off of it in an article that like, it's because there's a baseline, it sounds like really demanding, but like ultimately, maybe for some people, sometimes it could be really hard depending where you live. And it's really difficult maybe to get food that's kosher in certain centuries, not necessarily the one we're living in today. But in the end of the day, it is about like what we're actively doing. And it connects to that medieval position of the Ramban, I think.
Yeah, and that's actually a great segue with another source idea I wanted to develop, the clay yakar on our parsha, Perek Yud-Tet, Pasuk Dalet, really Dalet He. He brings the Pasuk Lirtzom Chem, right? It's within a larger commentary on Pasuk Dalet. He references Pasuk He. And he says as follows, for you will sacrifice it only according to your will, as if to say you shouldn't have any coercion causing you to sacrifice, nor should you have any foreign intention. I want to come back to that. You should only intend it to create joy or pleasure before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And, you know, therein also lies something very profound. There are times we have to do things, right? We have to sacrifice. But that doesn't mean we have to look at it from a place of reluctance, imposition, or coercion. It can be willing, right? Willingly aware. And this idea of to create joy or pleasure for God, right? How many times do we do something we don't want to do knowing it creates joy and pleasure? So I'm always interested in the relational aspects. Sometimes we can focus on the happiness it's going to bring another. What we really shouldn't do is have foreign intention, right? That will always bring me a little bit to sexual ethics or Jewish sexual ethics, right? You know, that when you're in an intimate relationship, you shouldn't be thinking about anyone else. You should be focusing completely on your partner. And certainly there shouldn't be coercion, right? So if intimacy, physical intimacy, is a microcosm, a little bit for spiritual intimacy, then some of the same requirements hold true in spiritual relationship with God, emotional and physical relationship with other, right? These are just hallmarks of what we're striving for when we strive to bring some of that reflection of God's image into the world through this prism we're calling Kedusha.
You know what I think is also interesting is that we're speaking, you and I, so clearly about the parallels between the human relationship and relationship with God. But the truth is that we work in it as part of our profession, Chama. And many of us, you know, unless you're a therapist or that you work in the sort of like side alleys that we go down of Hadrachat Kalot or Ye'utz Zugi, a couple counseling, you know, most people don't really sit and quantify what makes up a good intimate relationship. Again, I don't mean intimate sexually. That's also part of it. But I mean the whole bit. And what the Torah is doing, I think this is, I'm just echoing, I hope, what you're saying, is the Torah is trying to put out clear stipulations. Now, we go through life and no one gave us a handbook about how to create good relationships. We are part of a family. If our family is positive modeling, if we have then good friendships, and then we can create good relationships with our loved ones and spouses in the future. But the Torah is sort of trying to give you a blueprint for how to do that with God. And so like you keep bouncing back naturally to, oh, clearly human relationships work this way. But we forget that most people don't really sit and pontificate about these ideas. They're part of relationships. Sometimes it works better. Sometimes it works less great. And so what the Torah is doing, I think, is really, as you're saying, like breaking it down into pieces. And so then we can bounce it back into our human relationships. But I'm just saying that the Torah is doing something that we don't actually often get that kind of, you know, rubric in our human relationships. But we can actually learn it retroactively back to those.
So something you said then is bringing me to maybe the last idea I want to share. And I really want to credit Rabbi Ira Kosowski. He has a wonderful book called The Amida that I've been learning with a student about holiness within a community. That really, if we live on a mountaintop, right, so we can't do any harm, right? We live alone and maybe we can pray and learn Torah and we can keep Shabbat, right? But Parsha Kedoshim is all about relationship. It's about the poor and the gleanings and about and honoring parents and so on. And there is something to this idea that holiness is not just time or place. It's not only a certain category of people. It's when we act in a way that reveals God's presence, largely through the way we act towards other people, we bring holiness into the world. And he cited, because the book is on the Amida, he cited that that prayer that we say, the blessing that we say three times a day in the Amida, you are holy and your name is holy, and holy ones every day praise you, Selah. We are the holy ones, right? Everyone who praises God becomes the holy ones. And he brought the Kutzker Rebbe as saying as follows: each person has a part of God inside of them, and only through this part of God, who is the source of holiness, can the human being become holy. However, Moshe is told to speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, Kedoshim tihiyu, in plural, you be holy, because the more a person connects themselves with the community, the more they connect with the holiness embodied by that community. In the Torah, Judaism, our lives are meant to be practiced in relationship to one another, because that will also deepen our relationship, not only with the world, but with God. And we become holy by assessing and addressing and facing the challenges of personal relationships as part of communities. In our places of work, how many psukim, how many verses are directed at the morality in a workplace, right? Whether it's your weights and measures, whether it's, when you borrow things, when you return things, and so on. Of course, that we've taken it into more modern spaces today. But the Torah is so concerned with the way we interact and gives us that direction. And really, that is holiness. And we know manifesting many of God's values in the world can only happen when we're engaged in relationships and involved in our communities with one another. So there's another relational aspect that I think is begging for us to notice in this parsha, which has so many interesting intertwined mitzvot that are both about God upward, but very much outward, horizontally towards community.
You know, Nechama, I think that kind of explanation also has its root in the fact that connecting with God is a very hard thing to do, meaning we need other ways. It's kind of like a problem solving, right? Getting to God, that's a very high level for most of us humans. And so the Torah comes and says, you know, there are actually all different ways to kind of like take a crack at this. And there's all different ways that this Kedusha, in a second, I also just want to add one other idea that I think is important here, that there are all different ways you can sort of like come in contact with this Kedusha in the world, that, by the way, for many of us, they'll only come in contact with those other avenues, meaning to actually feel like they felt the presence of God, or they feel that they've really like tapped into like the depth of the world that God has created. Meaning those are very, very lofty ideas that many of us really don't ever get to. And I think that, so what also sits at the root of this kind of idea that you're expressing from Ira Kazowski, did I make up that name, right? Mm-hmm. That there's this, because many of us, we really only experience the real depth of life through our relationships with other people. And so while the ultimate goal may be to get to God, so to speak, it could be that for some, that's what they'll touch at. And that'll be okay, because it's a refraction of the Kedusha that God brings into the world.
Yeah. And I, you know, there's an idea that my father brought in the name of Rabbi Zevin. Kedoshim Tihiyu is being directed at each person who must go on their own personal journey, their own personal pursuit of Kedusha. For some people, it's going to be keeping the mitzvah, right? That God is too lofty, too far away, too grand, too frightening, perhaps too overwhelming. And having a blueprint for accessing Kedusha in bite-sized pieces, right? Again, the other people will find that very restricting, right? Yeah. If all I think about is every single halacha, every single mitzvah, and that's all it is to access God, then my relationship with God is going to be very dry and very limited. So this idea of Kedoshim Tihiyu, right? You each, every person has to take that mandate to themselves, right? And figure out the right way to walk that line. And the Meshech Chachma says, if we do not make ourselves holy, then holiness won't exist. Then God, who is holy, but God's holiness won't be personified into the world or embodied into the world, whatever word you want to use, if we are not seeking Kedusha. A little bit Heschel, right? God in search of man, man in search of God. That God also has intention, right, in gifting us Kedusha, because when we bring Kedusha out into the world, when we allow it to emanate from within us with our actions, with our choices, then God is more present in the world as well.
So that's, I really wanted to just sort of riff off of that. I do want to say that, and it's become again so common to source him that it almost becomes chas v'chila banal. But I want to just bring in a piece from Rabbi Sacks, because I happen to think that it's interesting. The commentator that I'm really most obsessed with in the Book of Erica, which I've also been teaching as I've been teaching Parshat Shavua, is Radatz Hoffman. And Radatz Hoffman, he started writing his whole commentary on the Torah in Parshat Vayikra. I mean, his students collated his shirim from Breishit and Shemot, and he starts off. He does all of his like magnum opus definitions, big bombastic statements, he does in Vayikra. And it's very interesting because Rabbi Sacks doesn't say that anywhere, but his introduction to Vayikra is actually his longest introduction. He says, because I really want to make order with a bunch of really critical concepts for the Torah. And Be'inai, and again, I'm not like, you know, the biggest scholar in the world and haven't read every single thing he's ever written, but Be'inai, his introduction to the Book of Vayikra is actually one of his most breathtaking pieces that I've ever read of his. And I just wanted to bring in an idea, because I think that he really explains something, and it really directly relates to what the point you just said. And again, you can look at the introduction yourself to read it, you know, more in depth. This is, I think, believe pages 16 and 17 in the English. He says that holiness is essentially empty space. He says, where does he get to that from? The idea that holiness, meaning kedusha, right? Not just the word whole, right? But kedusha is something, it's created when there's an absence, right? Shabbat is kadosh, right? When we have an absence of creation. The Mishkan is kadosh, right? That these are spaces that are quote unquote empty of action. And he says that when you stop, when you cease from acting as a human, that's when you enable sort of something else to come in. And I'll give you a very real life example, that one of the biggest losses in our modern lives right now is because we're always connected to devices, we lose our mind meandering space, right? Just like that empty space when we'll be in the car or we're just walking somewhere. And on one hand, it's great because we can listen and we can be enriched all the time. On the other hand, we all know that it's like when we jump into the shower or when we even went to the bathroom and you have like no empty space. It's when, like, a lot of times creativity can, like, I know sometimes when I go on a run, like, and I'll like, a shear will like fall into my head. Okay. And that's really the feeling. And people, let's say, who are songwriters will say that when they went to sleep and they woke up, but you need empty space, so to speak, empty space for creativity to flow in. So that's how Rabbi Sacks actually, that's my metaphor, but that's how Rabbi Sacks describes Kedusha, that we have to create an open space for God to then come in there. So he says that what happens is that when you have that, he says also, think about the way the Mishkan is structured. It's very empty, right? There's a few kelim, but it's actually very open space. And he says that it's in that open space that we can connect with God and that we allow God to enter. And again, it goes into this general question of, you know, well, what do you mean God is everywhere? And that's the answer that Kabbalah gives, is that, well, God should be everywhere. But in order for us to be able to function, he contracts himself. And that's why we can't always feel God, because we would feel suffocated. We feel like the Anan that tries to stuff itself into the Mishkan. Moshe can't even get in there because it's full. And so God has to sort of minimize himself. And then we can touch. These are these little moments of touching God. And that's everything, from how I'm understanding you, that you've been describing until now. You have these spaces. It's in our human relationships. It's in our parental relationships. It's in our married relationships, that we are able to like touch upon these elements of Kedusha that in theory should be everywhere in the world, but they're not, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to function. You're laughing, which I want to know why in a second. The last thing I just wanted to say, again, it's not my idea, it's his, is that, because it goes right back to what we said earlier in the podcast. He says that purity laws, right, all of the laws we've been speaking about in all the episodes up until now, of contamination of dead bodies and tzaraat and hilchot nida and all the physical impurities, and that all of those laws create boundaries, and they don't necessarily have significance in and of themselves. You could disagree with that for sure, but that their major role is to create boundaries in this world, because if we're going to be coming in such close contact with God, then that has to have boundaries surrounding it, because we can't just come in close contact with God when we're, I don't know, doing something that's like highly inappropriate. So I don't know, it's something about the way that that was described, which again are ideas I'm sure that many of us are familiar with, something about it sort of like, especially that image of we have to create space. Like there's the last thing in the Chum, and then I really want to have to say, my dream for years was to have a large home that wasn't filled with stuff. I was minimalist before that word existed, okay? And my dream was to have like open space that like the kids could play in and I could just sit and enjoy and read a book. But it's because it's that feeling, because I love that feeling of something being open, that then we could really be available to receive, to both put content into it and to also receive whatever shefa, whatever kedusha that that space has to offer. Okay, there were a lot of facial expressions. I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay. You were talking about space, yeah. And you were talking about tzimtzum and God actually have to constrict in the Kabbalistic sense in order to make room for us, right? For the world and particularly for human beings. And I thought of a conversation I had recently with a woman whose son is getting married, and there's tension there. We all want our children to get married. What we don't recognize is that means a person from outside comes into our family. And
surprise.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
That's complicated. And I used that language of when my daughter got married, learning lahaktina tatsmi, to make myself smaller, in or not because I was self-deprecating or anything, but because I recognized I took too much space in my relationship with the man she was bringing home, and that I had to make space. Literally, that's how I felt, that I had to constrict.
Totally.
It wasn't about me, and it wasn't about my opinions and my ideology and my world experience. Like, it was going to be all about that. Then there wasn't going to be room for this new person to come in, and then that person wasn't going to like coming. And my goal was to make sure my daughter and her husband come in. And I was sharing this. I'm not sure the woman could hear it. She's still very much in the space of not wanting to make space, right? Mm-hmm. Wanting everything to stay the way it was, not wanting to make space for what is a new entity, right? This new young man and his bride are a new entity that are going to take up more space. Mm-hmm. And if you don't retract, it's going to be very crowded and very tense in there. And I thought, right, that Kabbalah, right, even God has to do that, right, in order to make room for us. And in order for us to then access God, there has to be space. And the best teachers make space for their students, right? This idea that I can lecture and I can pontificate, you used that word before, right? Like we can all take up so much space with our wonderful ideas and our wonderful interpretations and so on. But we lose a lot if we don't open up space for our students to be able to express themselves and engage and come up with their own thoughts and ideas and give them permission to do so. So I think we started with, you know, as we were talking, it's all really coming together, right? Frameworks, by the way, are often very necessary for space, right? For creating the boundaries so that there's space. And otherwise, we can think about neighbors, Bava Batra, right? The tractate is all about creating walls that make clear what is your space, what is my space, because it's very easy for us to take up too much space, right? To spill over, to overflow into other people's spaces, and then there's no room. So I really love that, coming back to Kedusha. There's a happiness study, which Harvard launched, I think, in the 1930s and something like 75-year study, that the people who were happiest and healthiest were the people in good relationships. And so, semicolon, holiness is best found when we are connected with others, semicolon. This is because true holiness is what gives our life meaning, right? In other words, if I then go to happiness is found in relationship and holiness is best expressed in relationship, then ultimately, you know, happiness and holiness can certainly intertwine in giving my life meaning in relationship to others and in relationship to God. I mean, I'm going to always constantly go back and say relationship to God is a deeply meaningful relationship. But, you know, the question is, how do we want to access it?
Nechama, thank you for this conversation. I think that, really beautiful. I think that it's really given our listeners a lot to think about. I know I have been thinking about it since we said that this was going to be the topic of our conversation. And I think it also just to bring this to a close, it always reminds me of this idea as well that, you know, the Torah begins with a book about relationships with people, because ultimately that will be our greatest teacher when it comes to how to approach God. Sefer Bereishit has to come before Sefer Shmot. We don't come into the world and meet God. We come into the world and meet parents, and we suckle, and we learn to walk, and we do all these very physical activities. And then hopefully, when we reach a certain level of maturity, we'll be able to reach beyond that and see beyond that and sense beyond that, and then to be able to touch something that's much more transcendent than those physical capabilities. So I feel like this conversation also really sort of again brought that truth into our view. So thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode from Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please contact the Matan office or email me at podcast@matan.org.il. Please do us and all women's Torah learning a favor and share this episode with all of your friends and family.